It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Czechoslovakia was a sovereign state in Central Europe, existing from 1918 until its peaceful dissolution into the Czech and Slovak republics in 1993. What many people probably don't know is Pittsburgh's role in the history of Czechoslovakia. Here to tell us about the role the city played in the creation of the Czechoslovak nation is E. Maxine Bruins, director of the University of Pittsburgh Nationality Rooms and Intercultural Exchange Programs. E. Maxine Bruins, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Dankeschön. Thank you very much.
We won't keep our audience in suspense any longer. What role did Pittsburgh play in the creation of Czechoslovakia?
Well, from the 1890s until 1913, hundreds of thousands of Czechs and Slovaks came from Austria-Hungary to America, and many of them settled in Pittsburgh. During World War I, there was a group of nationalists in Paris. They were inspired by Woodrow Wilson's vision of ethnic sovereignty for the Central European peoples. And this group decided to promote an independent Czechoslovak state out of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. In 1918, Tomáš G. Masaryk, a leader of the nationalists, came to Pittsburgh seeking support for that proposed nation. More than 20,000 Slovak Pittsburghers gathered at the train station in Pittsburgh to hear him speak. This was the largest political gathering Pittsburgh had ever seen. The Pittsburghers urged him to put his proposal in writing, and they added their signatures to his declaration. And this statement, known as the Pittsburgh Agreement, was then sent down to President Woodrow Wilson himself. And this was the catalyst for Wilson's recognition of the new sovereign nation of Czechoslovakia. Tomáš Masaryk's portrait in bronze is at the front of the Czechoslovak Nationality Room. It is flanked by the nation's motto, Pravda vítězí, truth conquers.
Right up there in the Cathedral of Learning.
Yes.
And tell us a little more about Tomáš Masaryk. What should we know about him?
Yes. Well, he was a professor, a philosopher, and a member of the Austrian Parliament. But he and Edward Beneš and Milan Štefanik met in Paris to promote this Czechoslovak state. The Austrians declared them as traitors, and they imprisoned his daughter for a year. And it was he who came to Pittsburgh to seek this support. And after he was elected Czechoslovak's first president, known as the President Liberator, he held office until ill health forced him to resign in 1935.
This year is the 95th anniversary of the Pittsburgh Agreement. Tell us about some of the plans that are underway to mark the occasion.
Well, a Czech delegation led by the Senate President Milan Štech and Ambassador Petr Gandalovich will visit the Czechoslovak Nationality Room, where a copy of the Pittsburgh Agreement is on display, and Tomáš Masaryk is honored. And they will be accompanied by a member of the Czech Parliament and 12 members of the Czech Chamber of Commerce. And the delegation will attend ceremonies at the Heinz History Center. This is community-wide to celebrate the 95th anniversary of the Pittsburgh Agreement.
And there are memorials in the city to commemorate this event.
Yeah, the Pittsburgh Agreement was signed in the old Loyal Order of Moose building downtown. The Pittsburgh Cultural Trust set aside a space for the historical memorial in the CNG Tower, which was built on the site of Moose Hall. The memorial was proposed by an ad hoc committee headed by Marianne Sivak, who was secretary of the Czechoslovak Room Committee. It was created by Pittsburgh artists with the financial assistance of the Cultural Trust. The memorial features large bronze relief portraits of Tomáš Masaryk and President Woodrow Wilson, a copy of the Pittsburgh Agreement, a map of Czechoslovakia, and a rendering of the Moose Building.
You know, I'm curious because the 50th anniversary of this event would have been 1968, which was a very turbulent year in Czechoslovakia. Mm-hmm. which at that time was behind what was referred to as the Iron Curtain, under Soviet domination, and trying to break free of that.
Yes.
Do you remember anything about how this event that we're talking about now was celebrated in that year, and how the context of that celebration might be contrasted with a year like this one, where the Czech Republic, as it's now known, is free?
Yes. Yes, and it's separate. There is no longer a Czechoslovakia.
Right.
There's a Czech Republic and Slovak Republic. And I was going over there carrying a script of the biography of Alice Masaryk, the daughter of Thomas G. Masaryk, and things were really rather strange. There was a day of shame celebrated in Prague. I happened to arrive from a plane just coming into Wenceslas Square with an outburst of people opposing communism, and people handed me a little red, white, and blue ribbon with a black band across it, and tanks were there. It was just crazy. And that's what was going on in those days.
And now, obviously, things are much more calm. But there are still challenges for the Czechs and the Slovaks.
Yes, I'm sure there are, as there is for us right here in good old America. But at the dedication of this memorial in 1989, the rector of Comenius University in Bratislava presented a contemporary copy of the Pittsburgh Agreement to Milan Getting. Getting's father was one of the original signers, and Mr. Getting then generously donated this document to the university. It's on permanent display in the Czechoslovak Nationality Room.
And there is information about the agreement. If people go up to that nationality room, the Czechoslovakian nationality room at the University of Pittsburgh, they can learn more about what we're talking about?
We have tours, and you won't find it by just walking in the room. You can read the agreement, but you probably won't realize how important it was to the history of this nation. But if you take a tour with one of our 30 guides, then you can – or a tape tour.
Or look you up.
Or me. Yes, of course. I'd be happy to.
E. Maxine Bruins is at the University of Pittsburgh. She's director of the Pitt Nationality Rooms and Intercultural Exchange Program. She joined us here in Studio A. E. Maxine Bruins, thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
A pleasure. Thank you.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. With over 250 mills and factories, the Steel City and Allegheny County produced half of the steel and much of the munitions used by the Allies during World War I. But Pittsburgh gave more than steel to the war effort. A new book called Pittsburgh in World War I, Arsenal of the Allies, by La Roche College archivist Elizabeth Williams, examines Pittsburgh's varying contributions to the Allied cause during the Great War, as it was called. She joins us in Studio A. Elizabeth Williams, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
While I practice saying La Roche College archivist, I'm going to ask you, what strikes you most about this era that was touched by war?
Oh, well, there was so much. I mean, I didn't even realize how much Pittsburgh had actually done until I started researching it. The language of the war, everything was a battle for democracy against Germany. And even the contributions that Pittsburgh made, I didn't realize that Westinghouse was the first American company to be approached by the British government in 1914. I didn't realize that we had the first American airmen or one of the first casualties. And our Red Cross was – our Red Cross chapter was the biggest in the country, and we gave a lot of money towards the war effort.
And so Pittsburgh and the United States in general was involved with the war from a business standpoint before we as a nation got involved in 1917.
Yes. we were economically tied with the Allied powers almost from the beginning.
And this was these were no small contracts, I'm guessing, considering all of the raw materials that were needed for manufacturing.
Yes. When Westinghouse was approached in December of 1914, the British government wanted 3 million shells made for them. And Westinghouse wasn't a munitions company, of course, so they had to figure out how to make the shells. And only 2% of the tools and none of the machinery in their factory could be useful in making the shells, but they still fulfilled the order in 45 days.
And so they chose Westinghouse. Could they have gone anywhere else for this?
I think they could have pretty much gone anywhere. I don't know. I never found out in my research why they chose Westinghouse, just that Westinghouse was the first American company.
Let's talk a little bit about the whole climate, where the nation was and where Pittsburgh was before the United States got involved in the war. After it broke out in 1914, it sounds like the different ethnicities, particularly in Pittsburgh, having come from various parts of Europe, representing the areas that were involved in the war, that the city was divided over it.
Yes. I mean, in 1914, before the Lusitania sunk in 1915, Pittsburghers, by and large, were willing to just kind of wait and see. You know, we were economically tied with the Allies. But the German community in Pittsburgh especially was exceptionally pro-German, obviously. That was the fatherland. And even after the Lusitania sunk, which was one of the turning points in American sentiments during the war, after the Lusitania was sunk by the British – or by the Germans. It was a British vessel. And Americans died. One of Pittsburgh's leading German newspapers presented it as, look at German military prowess.
Really?
And not, yes.
And how did people react to that?
Not well.
I don't imagine they did.
Yes.
The Lusitania, in fact, wasn't that used as one of the ways to motivate the U.S. to get involved in the
war? Yes.
And one of the things that I have read about when – once the United States did get involved in the war, the things that were – that had traditionally German names, for example, Dachshunds, we have one running around in this building as we speak, they were no longer to be referred to as Dachshunds but as Liberty Pups. What can you tell us about this Americanization of German things and names?
Yes, I didn't find any evidence specifically of that in Pittsburgh, but it was done all over the place, particularly in Chicago. There was a sentiment in Pittsburgh, though, after the U.S. entered the war, you couldn't be pro-German. There were fist fights over it on the streets in the city, actually. Especially in April of 1917, right after the U.S. declared war. And there was this real sense of, okay, now that the U.S. has entered, we have to throw everything behind the U.S. And even in the German community, it was that same newspaper that I talked about earlier. It was keep your mouth shut and do what you need to do. And the Germans, they ended up raising more for the American war effort, the German community in Pittsburgh, than they had for German-Austrian relief previously.
We're talking with Elizabeth Williams. She is the author of a new book about World War I and Pittsburgh's role in it called Pittsburgh in World War I, Arsenal of the Allies. And after the United States entered the war, there were a lot of casualties. This was a very, very brutal war. In fact, it was called the Great War because people thought this was going to be the war to end all wars. How much did Pittsburgh give to the war effort besides the production of steel and raw materials?
There were, I think, 60,000 men from Allegheny County who joined the service in 1917. Out of those 60,000, over 1,500 didn't come home, including Thomas Enright, who was one of the first three American casualties of the war. And we also gave more aviators to the war than any city, American city, other than New York.
So there was a tremendous sacrifice made by Pittsburgh and Allegheny County.
Mm-hmm.
And how did World War I change Pittsburgh?
World War I, for whatever brief period of time, Pittsburgh was more than just the Smoky City. It was the arsenal of the Allied powers, and that meant a lot to Pittsburghers. And after the war, there was the sense of this was the greatest thing to happen in our generation, and we need to celebrate it. And so they built monuments so that they wouldn't forget the sacrifices that every person in the city made towards the war effort. And there was this real sense of the war. I mean, when the armistice was announced, Pittsburghers poured out into the streets in celebration. That's how much the war itself meant to them, and that's how much it changed the generation.
And we see World War I monuments all over this city. What are some of the ones that stand out to you that you think are particularly noteworthy?
Well, in Lawrenceville, there's the Doughboy.
Right.
Which is probably the most famous war monument in Pittsburgh. I'm partial to the one in the neighborhood that I grew up in, which is in Greenfield, and it's right – you pass Coco's, and it's right by the entrance to the parkway, and it's actually – dedicated to Greenfielders from World War I and World War II who served in both wars, or who served in World War I and then who served in World War II, so it's kind of a double. And then there is a beautiful one outside of Phipps Conservatory, which is the Medical Society.
There was the feeling at the end of World War I that there would not be another war like this. In fact, we only call it World War I since the Second World War started because they weren't giving numbers to it. They thought this was the end of the line. And certainly there are many people who wish that it had been. But since then, we haven't seen the kind of memorials to the wars that have come since World War I. Why do you suppose that so much attention has been paid to World War I, even in retrospect, that we haven't acknowledged subsequent wars the way we still acknowledge World War I?
I think that, well, as far as monuments go, there was a lot of money that was around in Pittsburgh, especially in the 1920s, right after the war, and I think that contributed to it. The Doughboy in Lawrenceville was only built because they had raised money for the war effort, and then the war ended. So they thought that this was a proper way to spend that money. So there was that, and there was really the sense of, I mean, when I read that when the armistice was announced that Pittsburghers flooded the streets in celebration and there were impromptu parades, the only thing that I could equivalent that with in my lifetime was when the Steelers won the Super Bowl. So there's that sense of, especially after World War II, that people just don't have that personal connection anymore that they did in World War I and World War II.
We're talking with Elizabeth Williams, author of Pittsburgh in World War I, Arsenal of the Allies. You have a very interesting personal story as you embarked on writing this book. A lot was going on in your life. Tell us how you got interested in this and then proceeded to write the book and what was happening while you were writing it.
I got interested in this because, well, as I mentioned, the war monument in Greenfield before, I stopped to look at it for the first time, I think, in my entire life. And I'm like, hey, I wonder what Pittsburgh was like during World War I. When a book didn't exist, I thought, oh, I can write that myself. Well, I got the book contract, and then I got engaged that same month. So it was a whirlwind of trying to plan a wedding for 200 people and write a book. And I worked at Duquesne at the time, and I also picked up an adjunct class at Seton Hill. So it was a bit crazy in my life.
But you managed to do this in a year, which is remarkable.
Yes.
How much – you must have spent an awful lot of time, long days working on this.
Yes, I had absolutely no life outside of the book and the wedding, but
– And now that it's been published, what's the response been?
It's been very positive so far, I think.
And certainly a moment in – not only in world history but in Pittsburgh's history that should be well remembered.
Yes.
Elizabeth Williams is the author of Pittsburgh in World War I, Arsenal of the Allies – and she joined us here in Studio A. Elizabeth, it's been a pleasure meeting and visiting with you. Thanks so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes, and thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, World Affairs Council President and CEO Steve Sokol will be sitting in the host chair with a look at how the economic climate of China could impact that of Pittsburgh. Thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. You can catch the entire show online at WESA.FM or as a podcast in iTunes. And we welcome your comments and story ideas at ESSPGH at WESA.FM. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and this is 90.5 WESA, Pittsburgh's NPR news station.